Hello, beautiful souls. You are listening to the Curious Monkey Podcast, where you're invited to join me, a curious nugget, as I go on a journey to dive deep and learn about the world of yoga, as well as everything in and around it. Poses, teacher training, and super cool topics like energy healing and crystal bowls. You'll hear it all. I'm your host, Veronica Tai. Welcome to the conversation. Hi, everybody. Welcome to today's episode. Thanks for tuning in. Today, I've got Dani Holt with me. Dani is a fellow yoga teacher. Her and I actually took our yoga teacher training together. She is a registered nurse during the day. And of course, on her free time, she's doing none other but teaching yoga, currently at a community center. Dani, is there anything that I can add to your introduction?
Just thank you so much for having me, and I'm excited to chat.
Me too. So let's start with getting to know Dani a little bit better. Dani, can you tell us a little bit about your journey with yoga?
I began practicing yoga as a teenager at a gym by my house, kind of not really knowing what I was getting into, and thought it was something so new and cool. And over the past few years of my adult life, it's just become more of a regular thing for me. And then moving to Calgary, I found more of a yoga community here, and it really helped to enrich my practice. And then, of course, yoga teacher training has just taken it so much deeper than I ever thought possible, but it's been a really great learning experience.
Yeah, totally. You know, I love hearing about everybody's first time with yoga because it's so diverse. For me, I was there for a good workout, and I definitely did not know the depth that yoga can take us to. And again, not until teacher training. How about you? How old were you when you had your first experience, and did you like it right off the bat, or were you like, okay, that was cool and different?
I think I was about 15 or 16, and I was definitely in it for the workout. I did it at a gym, but the lady who taught it was super cool, and I just remember thinking, this is something totally different than I had experienced. I spent my free time in dance classes, so very regimented, and I just thought this was such a cool way to move your body more free and kind of relax, and so accepting. And the relaxation part at the end, I remember loving that and thinking like, whoa, this is so cool. Definitely started for the workout and then slowly evolved into something more than that for me.
Again, it's always very diverse, people's first experience with yoga. Sometimes we hate it and we shut the door on it until later on when it does find us when it needs to. But I'm glad you had a positive experience. You mentioned at the beginning it was just about the workout. What does yoga mean to you now?
Yoga to me now is sort of a place where I can find some peace and quiet and consistency in my life. Focuses on, I find so many positive things, and it's really been a positive impact on my life in the past few years, especially I've noticed as I've started to practice more regularly. It's definitely been a huge contributor to positive mental health for me, physical health, and just building community as well around me and meeting so many great people.
Does it tie into your job as a registered nurse at all?
Definitely. I think it helps me to focus on presence. I work actually in an emergency department, so very high stress. I like to say that yoga is sort of the yin to my yang, and trying to bring back down to presence and concentration and sort of letting things go. Definitely, I'd like for it to be more of an impact in my nursing career. I've been trying to sort of bring some of those qualities in, but it's definitely helped me.
For sure, I think the more that we can bring yoga into our everyday lives, the more peace, the more positivity that we'll find. And for those of you, if you haven't met Dani yet, she's probably the most down-to-earth, calm kind of girl that I've ever met. So when you say yin to your yang, I have not seen a fiery yang yet. I can see why you'd be very suitable for the emergency response team, just because you're so down-to-earth and grounded.
Well, I'm glad I project that here, but I know sometimes at work you gotta be a little bit fiery, so it's definitely nice to try and find the peace outside of work.
Thanks, Dani. Okay, let's move on to the topic that we're going to talk about today. And today, you guys, it goes with what we were talking about. It's not just about the pose. It's not just about the workout. In fact, there are eight limbs to yoga. Patanjali, the father of yoga, created sort of this recipe for us to find enlightenment. And while there are only eight steps, some of us can spend a whole lifetime in just one. Let me tell you a little bit more. So there's the yamas, The niyamas, restraints that we have in ourselves, in our practice. Niyamas, observances. Asanas, which are the poses. So this is where we mostly sit in North America. We sit in the asanas, down dog, chaturanga, your vinyasas. Then we move on to pranayama, which is breath. And one quote that I just read today is, the mind is in control of your life and your breath is in control of your mind. So if you can master your breath, master your breathing, that's where you're going to connect to the source energy, whatever you believe that may be. Next, on the fifth limb, we have pratyahara, which is withdrawal of the senses, learning to be feeling connected outside of your body. See, now it gets intense. And then we have dharana, which is intense focus, which brings you to the state of meditation. And then finally, the coveted samadhi, which is a state of oneness. That is enlightenment. So as the humble people that Danny and I are, we'll focus on the yamas and niyamas today. Step one, the yamas being the restraints, the things that we can practice that will cultivate a moral compass for us to deal with ourselves, what integrity means to us, where we're going to take our next step and why. We'll touch on each of the yamas, but before that, Danny, I want to catch up with you. When we did yoga teacher training, we had to choose one of the yamas, of the restraints that we were to practice on. Can you tell us which restraint you chose and your journey through that, even up until present day?
I remember for yoga teacher training, sitting down and looking through each of them, and I ended up settling on ahimsa, the non-violence, non-harm, which I thought at first seemed pretty self-explanatory. Like I certainly don't go around being violent with people. I thought, oh yeah, I have that one. But the more I thought about it and sort of the deeper we went into it, I realized it's nonviolence in thought, action, and that can come out in different ways in life through things like gossip, intention in interacting with people. So I decided to go with that one and just sort of explore what that meant for me. And it was definitely quite a learning experience and still something I would say I work on every day. I think everybody does to some capacity. And when you just think about taking them further than the surface and how deep they can go, that was a great learning experience for me.
Yeah. So ahimsa, it means non-injury, non-violence. And that's the one that I chose to work on during yoga teacher training. by no means does it take just 8 months to master. I think this could be a lifetime. And was it not a story that our teachers told us during yoga teacher training of a young student in India who was seeking a guru? And he sought this great guru far and wide. And when he finally found the guru, he said, "Guru, will you teach me the path to enlightenment?" And so the guru goes through the first two yamas. So the first limb being the yamas. And within the yamas, we've got ahimsa, which is non-injury, being the first one. And then satya, truthfulness, being the second one. We'll talk about that in a little bit. This young student says, "Okay, guru, I will return once I have mastered the first two yamas." And he never did return. This humble student was actually Gandhi. And Gandhi had devoted his entire life to non-harm and truthfulness. This is how deep these concepts can go. So ahimsa to me, Danny, the first thing that I thought of was exactly on the same track as you. Oh, non-harm. Okay, so I get angry once in a while, but no, I've never punched anyone in the face. Like, I think I've got this. And then it was such a revelation to realize ahimsa, non-injury, can be thoughts. And it mostly pertains to ourselves. And that's when it got hard for me. How often are we hard on ourselves? How often are we just so darn nasty to ourselves, meaner than any other external person would be?
I found for me too, when focusing on ahimsa, it's funny, the way I approached it was like, okay, you know, I'm really going to look at myself and be critical and, you know, really hone in on my thoughts. So anytime I have a judgmental thought, you know, I need to be better. And I kept kind of trying to change myself and approaching it from a critical point of view towards myself. And then finally, one day, I don't know what it was that set it off, but I realized I'm approaching this in a way that is already judgmental and critical of myself, which is already against the purpose of ahimsa. Like, I was already being hard on myself and not realizing that first you have to apply that to yourself generally before you can extend that to others. So that was a huge eye opener for me. And I think like I said, I think it's something people work on every day, but it was so just eye-opening to see that we generally are so hard on ourselves.
Yeah. And then it gets super twisted, right? Because you are noticing, being aware of ahimsa, non-injury, non-violence, you realize that that pertains to yourself. And so when you start judging yourself, you judge yourself for judging yourself. You get into this vicious cycle. So after all this time in bringing extra awareness, what lesson would you share? Do you have to share with everyone?
I think it would just be, you know, nothing that hasn't been said before, but just realizing truly that for yourself, you have to extend yourself that kindness as well and allow yourself to feel what you need to feel. Approach yourself with compassion. And then once you've done that, it's easy to extend it to others. And also just realizing that we're all here, we're all experiencing suffering and experiences in different ways. And just to understand that we're all here to experience happiness and everybody's searching for happiness and good things and just sort of
that's the common denominator.
Yeah,
hey?
Exactly.
Yeah. I think for me over the last few years where I've been considering bringing more awareness to ahimsa, it's the hiss but not bite. So another story that we had learned during yoga teacher training is a story of this giant terrorizing serpent who would terrorize the village. And upon meeting a monk, the monk teaches him about ahimsa, non-injury, and the eight paths to yoga towards love, enlightenment. And the serpent says, okay, wow, I'm going to take that to heart. And when the monk revisited that same village the next year, this grand, powerful serpent had shriveled into this poor little thing, kind of beat up. And it's because the kids were terrorizing him. He stopped terrorizing the village and the kids were terrorizing him. And the monk says, well, gosh, what happened to you? And he said, I took what you said to heart. And the monk rebuttals with, well, I said don't bite, but I never said not to hiss. When I learned that, Danny, in yoga teacher training, I was so confused. I was frustrated, really, because here I am trying to be the best person that I could, making as many people as happy as possible, but sometimes feeling taken advantage of or not 100% good. It didn't feel that good. And through the last few years and considering ahimsa and considering this piece, I finally realized, guess what? You're worth it too. So I'm worth it too. So if there's something that's done that's going to make someone else happy, but it's not going to make me happy, I get to say something. And it could be as simple as, if you want pizza tonight, but I'm really wanting some Thai food, I get to say that I have Thai food. And that all has to do with self-worth too, which I think ties into ahimsa.
Absolutely. And sometimes it's hard to find that hiss at a place that you're comfortable with. And I think it takes a while to find that voice that you feel okay to sort of say and express to other people.
Yeah. So let's move on to the next one. Satya, truthfulness. What does that mean to you?
I found that truthfulness, again, is another one just like ahimsa, where on the surface you think like, yeah, I practice that every day. I'm certain, you know, I don't think I'm walking around lying to people in any capacity. But I found we do tell a lot of little white lies when we step back.
No, we had talked about that. And what that means when it comes to practicing the eight limb path. What is a white lie? How are you? I'm good. I'm good. You could be bad, like so bad, but you're at work. So what does that all mean?
And when is it appropriate and when is it not? And trying to find that comfort and balance for yourself, but still maintaining that honesty to yourself and to others.
So since our training and since your awareness of this yama, how have you changed the way that you act in terms of satya?
I think in general, day-to-day, how are you? I probably haven't changed much there, like in the passing by. But I think in partnerships and deeper relationships, being able to honestly say what you feel you need from the moment and applying, I think that ties into ahimsa. The thing about these we found it was that you can't always disconnect one yama from the other because they're so interconnected.
Yeah, it's true.
But knowing what I need, you know, from a partner and then having the self-love and self-awareness to express that through truthfulness. And I found that's deepened relationships. And I think a lot of that comes with maturity as well. But it's been interesting to see sort of trying to express what you need from somebody and, you know, be able to honestly and openly do that.
Yeah, I'd say so. And the relationship piece that you brought up, it is so important. I used to think of confrontation as aggressive, unkind, and undesirable. But you know what? Confrontation doesn't need to be that way. It's about talking about your boundaries and setting it. If something that you do bothers me and I take it and I don't say anything, then I'm not being truthful to you or me. And how can our relationship go deeper? Mm-hmm. Because we work on a basis assuming that we're all here to make each other happy. And it is. It's human nature to want to make a loved one happy. So I'd say that ties into Satya as well, the truthfulness and the... Oh, sorry. Go on.
And I would agree with that. But even then, looking deeper and saying, when someone does something that makes you unhappy, stepping back and looking at yourself and thinking, what truly is it about this action that makes me unhappy? Is it striking an insecurity within me, or is it not respecting a boundary? So really looking and being truthful with yourself about why you're having that reaction to what you're feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. And once again, you remind us, Danny, that these yamas are layers upon layers upon layers. To anyone who's listening, what we're talking about today, it's just a sampler. Mm-hmm. It's like a little sample plate to show you what's all out there. And then you can proceed spending your entire life, just like Gandhi did, to own it, to understand it, to study it. The last thing I had to say about Satya is speaking our truth. We talk a lot about that during yoga. Sometimes you hear yoga teachers say it quite often. At first, I loved it and I was on board and I was like, yeah. And then I stopped myself because I realized it's this lingo that sounds good, but I didn't understand it. I hadn't studied it. And that's where it ties to Satya, truthfulness, saying what we really mean. And for me, even if it means if I don't feel like going to a party, I'm not going to say, well, maybe I'll let you know I've changed the way I've acted, because then I don't have to have that kind of, in a way, untruthful tie. If I know I'm not going, I actually say, you know what? I won't be able to make it tonight. Mm-hmm. And it has brought for myself quite a bit of peace.
And I think for other people too, it brings a trustfulness in that relationship and knowing that what you say, you genuinely mean and plan to follow through with. And the other part too, I just in thinking this over, some of the more concrete examples that were offered, I remember in our training for truthfulness was even in doing asanas, being truthful with yourself and how your body is truly feeling and honoring you know, the pains you may be having or where your body's at that day.
Yeah.
And I think for us, that was more applicable because it's easier and more tangible to explain to a student.
That's where we sit. Yeah. That's where we sit most of the time. Okay, let's move on to the third one, asteya. I think that's how you say it. This one means non-stealing. Does this one resonate with you, or do you have much of a relationship with it?
I think all of them resonated with me for sure on some level. Non-stealing, especially when the example of time was brought up. How do we steal time from ourselves and from other people? That was a huge one, especially in today's world where it's so easy to lose mindfulness and to let time be stolen through our phones, through Facebook. And so definitely, I think that that's maybe not one that I have in the forefront of my mind, but certainly one that I could work on in my daily life.
Yeah, yeah. I know this one doesn't resonate fully with me yet. Non-stealing. And I see it at a shallow level and as well as one layer down, a little bit of a deeper level. I'm sure, like all the other ones, there's layers upon layers upon layers. But where I've gotten with asteya, the non-stealing, is when we look at it tangibly, it really isn't taking someone else's time. So if you're meeting a friend, try your best to be on time. I'm guilty for being... for being at least 15 minutes late to things. So I try and I do make an effort because time is all we've got. I don't want to take that away from someone else. It also means that for me, and I do take this one quite seriously, when I'm teaching a yoga class, I'm there and I'm prepared and I'm ready to make the most of my students' time. Then when I look at it a bit deeper, that's when it gets convoluted with me because it really starts to tie into, and you've said this a couple times, Satya. The truthfulness. And what I mean by that is non-stealing, not stealing from yourself. And like the example you gave earlier, if you can do it, then why would you steal that away from yourself? Or for yourself not to shine in your fullest potential, to bask in the brilliance that everything that you are, forgetting that so much of the time. That's stealing from actually the rest of the world.
Ooh.
That's stealing because they don't get the full you.
Yes.
And that's a hard one. It feels good to say it and it feels good to remember it. And then it feels bad because where are we 80% of our time? We're in our heads telling ourselves how we're not good enough or we need to work harder or this isn't, we're not there yet, and trying our best to come up with excuses as to why we're not amazing. So that's as far as I've gotten with that.
And layers on layers. You just layered right on top of ahimsa, satya, and it's true. And I totally understand now why they're in the order that they're presented as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And what a deep thing to touch on is you're stealing from the world by not living up to your potential and from your own happiness. So yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the fourth one that we've got is brahmacharya. It's control of senses or celibacy. So celibacy, when we first talked about it, it made me go,
this was the one I think that when I heard about it, I was like, I don't think I'm going to be participating in that one. I don't want to be giving up any of my pleasures in life, eating,
yes,
whatever it may be. But this one too, once we talked about it a little bit more, I sort of began to realize that, again, it's such a layered conversation to be having.
Yeah.
And how we can overindulge, going back to non-stealing in things like social media or that type of thing, and then how that does steal time away from us. And it's kind of any overindulgence and being honest with what you need.
Yeah. And that was the same kind of thinking that I had when it was first introduced. I was like, yeah, no, I'm just going to go ahead and bypass that one. Hopefully I'll still be enlightened. But really, when you think about brahmacharya, the word celibacy, I think is just too potent. It's too strong. That's not necessarily what they mean. And when we say control of our senses, I think I had gone way towards the other end thinking, oh, that's where you get no pleasure whatsoever. But not necessarily. It doesn't mean that we'll never watch TV, we'll never have ice cream, we'll never have wine. It's doing it mindfully.
Yes.
And that's when mindfulness comes into the practice. So yeah, if your intention of logging onto Facebook is to connect, and the connection makes you feel happy and makes you feel joy, and you're able to share some loving words with a friend, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then to mindlessly flip through Facebook just to see what's going on with no clear intention, no clear path, I think that's when we get into the zone of overindulgence.
I agree. And I think that's such a clear way of putting it that I hadn't actually considered before, is that it's applying mindfulness.
Yeah.
In how you're doing it. And being honest with yourself too. I mean, when you wake up the next morning after your fifth glass of wine, you're not going to feel,
yeah,
you know, exactly. You may think you need it at the time, but it's, you know, we're not doing ourselves any favors by sort of overindulging.
You bet. And food is another one too, right? When we talk about overindulgence. So it's one thing to share a delicious meal and just actually mindfully realize how delicious it was, enjoying every bit for what it was. And then there's another when you forget or you don't notice what you ate. And we've all had those times.
Absolutely.
Yeah, where you open a bag of chips and before you know it, you're reaching the bottom of the bag. You're like, what did I do? What was that?
Or you just spent 4 hours watching a TV series and you realize, where did my day go?
That was my example in class. I'm so bad for that. Because I turned off my brain. Because I came home and I think I had actually a distorted perception of what relaxation might be. Mm-hmm. And that's what I came up with after talking about brahmacharya. When I used to come home from a long day of work, what did I want? I want Modern Family. I didn't want just one. I wanted five. Because if one is relaxation, five is five times relaxation, right? And that's so untrue.
And going back to truthfulness and really checking in with yourself and taking time to really and truly examine, is this making me feel how I want it to? And is this contributing? And mindfully choosing activities that are going to contribute to that happiness and sense of well-being, and being honest with yourself if maybe one episode does, but maybe five doesn't. And I think that's a great way of kind of laying it out there.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe we have gotten further with Brahmacharya than we've thought. Okay, the last one of all is aparigraha, non-covetousness, non-hoarding, non-possessiveness. What does that mean to you?
This one I wasn't so sure on. And then I realized that it does apply, again, more than I thought it did. I think I found that for a lot of these.
Yeah.
And just knowing that sort of letting go of things can be so healthy in my life. And not getting too attached to ideas and objects. And one of my favorite, I don't know who originally said this, but sort of what you own ends up owning you. And I think that can be true in a lot of ways. And true with relationships, true with objects, true with ideas or rigid plans. And sometimes letting go of that and not possessing, not holding on to something can actually leave opportunity for so many more things if we would just allow ourselves to be present and mindful and sort of let go sometimes.
Yeah. I know that the Tibetan monks, they actually do this. Have you ever heard of it? Where they do these sand paintings, and it's meticulous and it is so finely detailed. Every grain of sand counts, and these monks come together and they create this gorgeous mandala out of this sand, out of this colored sand. And they do it for, I don't know how many hours or how many days, but they put all this work into it. And at the end, they wipe it clean.
Oh, wow.
I know. I watched this on Netflix, actually, and that moment, my heart hurt. I was like, no, your artwork. But that's the exact purpose of this artwork, to show the impermanence in life. And I think maybe that's what aparigraha alludes to as well. Mm-hmm. Non-permanence, it's not about the material things. We hear that quite a bit. But it's non-possessiveness and non-hoarding that I resonate with. The non-hoarding, that sentiment that I do have. So that movie ticket that I had on my first date when I was 16 or whatever it was, I keep it. That pen that works so darn well, I keep it.
I found for me, and I didn't know that it fit under aparigraha when I was first experiencing it in a yoga class, but one of my favorite things a teacher would say, and I think it was probably said several times before it actually resonated with me, was just simply to let go of what does not serve you here.
Yeah.
And when I finally was able to apply that to my practice, how powerful that was and how powerful it can be in my day-to-day life and interactions with other people. So knowing that even emotions, if they first come up like hostility as a reaction, I can let go of that if it's not going to serve me in that interaction. Not that I shouldn't say I can. I would like to be able to. But just knowing that you know, that's the goal, has been so powerful for me in my yoga practice and in being mindful and present. It feels like a lot of things come back to being mindful and present.
Yeah, I love that. So really it does, for me, it really does translate to that impermanence and making a choice of how permanent you want it to be. So it's one thing to save movie tickets from when you were young and you went on your first date, but it's another to save all your movie tickets from ever and ever and ever. Mm-hmm. That goes for emotions too. I like that you brought that up. You go out one night and most of the night was fun, but you had one encounter that was a little bit negative. So it's up to you, right? Was it enough for me to do something about? And if that's a no, then I'm just going to let it go. Mm-hmm.
Which is a huge thing.
It is, because oftentimes we have these negative encounters. And that's what they say about reading a book too, right? You read about 5,000 words that are correct, and that one typo is what you notice. And same with how we walk in this world as we go through our experiences. We go through so much joy, so much laughter. And if we're talking about that one night, as much fun as we did have, when someone asks us how it was, we might just come back to that one negative incident.
That's like, so true.
Yeah. Oh, we had to wait an hour and a half at the restaurant. But let that go. And when we let that go, we find a lot more peace and we flow with it.
Which might be, this is a great one, I think, to always keep in mind. It might be one that I want to focus on next because it's so true. And in letting go in that moment, in letting go of that negative emotion, oh, we're waiting, and not focusing on that.
Yeah.
Imagine what opportunities might be there. You know, that hour and a half might give you time to explore a new area or really have a great conversation with a friend.
Absolutely.
Or even a stranger.
Yeah. And
if we let go of that negativity, what could be?
Absolutely. And I think that's what aparigraha is, going with the flow, letting go. And that also means happiness, right? Because there are times where we feel so happy and we feel so good and it was so much fun, and we try to recreate it over and over and over in our minds, which seemingly is a positive thing, but it isn't really if we're unable to let go of it, enjoy it for what it's worth, and then you let it be.
And even in relationships, this is one I find you can always work on, in letting go of that possessiveness, and not in the sense of maybe what picture that cultivates in the mind of, you know, being so possessive, but in some ways we all do that, and knowing that being not possessive of your partner and just truly letting them like get whatever they need from life. Do you know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah, the non-possessiveness, because when we think about what possessiveness is when you go in there saying, this is mine, this is under my control. Mm-hmm. You will do as I wish, when I wish. So non-possessiveness, especially in a relationship, really is you are you and I love you and you go be you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Wow, Danny, maybe we've come a lot further than we thought. I know there's still so much more to go through in terms of understanding these yamas.
And it's really great to review and call to mind that, yeah, I'm going to focus back on these. And this is a great place to start. Yeah. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I love these conversations. I am reminded time and time again, when we talk about yoga without the asanas, the poses involved, how deep and how much there is to learn. For everyone out there, let me give you a summary of what we've gone through, because I know we've had one long conversation. We only touched on the first limb of the 8-limb path that Patanjali, the father of yoga, had put together for us as a path to enlightenment. And to summarize what the first limb is, it's the yamas. It is what helps us develop our moral compass and our character, guiding us as we walk this earth. And there are 5 yamas. We have ahimsa, non-injury, non-violence, satya, which is truthfulness, asteya, non-stealing, brahmacharya, control of senses, and finally, aparigraha, non-hoarding, non-possessiveness. And as me and Danny just had our revelation, I'd like to add the word impermanence to it. So Danny, just to wrap up our conversation here, leave us with a nugget. In everything that you've learned with this yoga and in your journey, what is the biggest lesson that you've learned so far?
That's a tough one. The biggest lesson for me might be just coming right back to mindfulness and presence in the moment, and truly recognizing that this moment is what we have and what matters, and to let go of what does not serve you. That's still my favorite quote ever said. It's so simple, but so true. And I know even in my work life as well, recognizing that impermanence and then using that as fuel to be mindful and present in each moment and appreciate it for what it is and take people in fully and take in the experience and give your true self. And certainly coming back to these yamas also, just to be able to, you know, really focus on that and focus on loving self and giving that to others and all the things that these mean. It's great to review, and I certainly want to focus back on that in my life.
Yeah, you bet. I'm sure we'll have future conversations about this. Now, if anyone had any additional questions that they wanted to ask you, well, how could we contact you?
You could certainly contact me on Facebook. I'm on Facebook, Danny Holt, or through my email, which I could give you to post as well.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Danny, so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. I will post all relevant links and resources on my website, veronicatai.com. And as always, let me know what you thought of this episode by commenting, liking, or subscribing. I'll catch you on the next episode.